So, the Satipatthana Sutta, this is the sutta that we're going to be following through this session. Sutta is a word that perhaps not everybody is familiar with. Sutta or sutra is a discourse or a teaching. And a sutta is usually a teaching that is said to be the word of the Buddha, a teaching that the Buddha gave, and at a later date has been put into written form. So they're often quite repetitive because it was initially an oral tradition. So the Satipatthana Sutta is the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness. It's his main teaching on mindfulness. And what we're doing in this session is that the structure of the weeks will, to some extent, follow the chapters in this book, Living with Awareness, which is Bhante Sangharakshita's seminar he did on this particular sutta. With any seminar material, it depends on who's there as to where it goes. It reflects the interests and the concerns of those who are present. So it's not a very sort of strict interpretation of everything that's in the sutta. But it is very interesting. It has a lot of real gems in it. If you want something that's going through the sutta in quite a lot of detail, then this is your book. This is Bhikkhu Anālayo, Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. So, both very, very good books. If you want to sort of follow through, if you haven't already done so in a group study or personal study, you might want to follow through by looking at one of these. I think they're probably both, I'm sure they're both in the library as well, if you just wanted to dip in. So in this session, there's going to be a variety of us leading different weeks, and I think in that way, you'll get a number of different approaches to mindfulness. You'll have different weeks of the material, but also approached through different minds and different sets of experience. So a bit like different sort of facets, different, if you think of a jewel, particularly say a crystal and you hold it up to the light or it's turning in the light, then you get different sort of colours, different sort of reflections of it. And what I hope is that you get a sense of mindfulness that is multifaceted, that is multicoloured, that you have an experience of awareness that becomes more rich or more subtle through this session. So Bhante Sangharakshita has talked about mindfulness as the defining quality of all Buddhist practice. And that it's absolutely central. You can't go anywhere without it. And one of my favourite lectures from, I don't know when he gave it, perhaps the 70s or early 80s, is one called Breaking Through to Buddhahood. And at the end of this lecture, he describes one of the figures of the mantras that we chant at the end of the puja. He describes Vajrapani, wrathful Vajrapani, this very sort of large figure, deep blue, big teeth, wearing a tiger skin. So this is the image he uses for this breaking through to Buddhahood. There's different ways of talking about mindfulness. So I'm just going to read you what Sangharakshita says in this lecture. He says, breaking through any aspect of conditioned existence, any aspect of the wheel of life is accomplished mainly through the cultivation of awareness. Awareness, mindfulness, and recollection. Awareness, we may say, is the great dissolver of negative emotions, of psychological conditionings, in fact, every aspect of the conditioned within ourselves. There is no spiritual life without awareness. An action, thought, or feeling is spiritual to the extent that it is accompanied by awareness. If there is anything negative in the thought, feeling, or action, anything that smacks of the conditioned, then the awareness with which it is done, if that awareness is maintained, it will sooner or later eat away all the conditioning and negativity. So awareness is of paramount importance in the spiritual life. There is no spiritual life, no breakthrough without awareness. So tonight I want to say a little bit about the background to the sutta. A little bit about the sutta itself, and then a little bit more, if you like, building up the qualities of awareness, following on from how Vajrapriya talked last week around the warp and the weft. But firstly, start with, without making any assumptions, what does Satipatthana mean? What does it actually mean? So we heard last week, sati is recollection, mindfulness. So Satipatthana is translated usually one of two ways. So either as a foundation of mindfulness. So that has sort of a sense of sort of firmness, something that you can sort of rest upon, a foundation of mindfulness. And the second meaning is more to do with attending to or placing near. So attending with mindfulness, attending to something with presence, with staying close to it. I think both of those translations give something slightly different. So, to just refer to a couple of things I put on the shrine. So, you may not be able to see them both, but on the road, the same road that the large candles are on, there's a head and shoulders of a wooden Buddha figure. I bought this figure in Bodh Gaya when I was there for the Indian convention a few years ago. Our international order convention was held in Bodh Gaya. On the front, on the slate, in the offering sort of slate, is a small round piece of wood, like shaped a bit like a lotus. Has little carvings, lotus-like carvings, and it has the imprint of feet. This is quite a common symbol, the imprint of the Buddha's feet on it. When I was in Bodh Gaya, I didn't have very much time, but I was able to make a couple of trips out. Had a day when I went to a couple of what they call the Buddhist sites. So I went to Raj Griha, Vulture's Peak, where the Buddha spoke, where the Buddha gave a teaching. And I went to Nalanda University, which was a massive university sort of for Buddhist monks, hundreds of years, perhaps 1,000 years after the Buddha's time. And I went to what's called Prag Bodhi Cave, a few miles from Bodh Gaya, the site of the Buddha's enlightenment. Prag Bodhi Cave, I tend to call Skinny Buddha Cave. It's where the Buddha did his ascetic practices. So there's this picture of this metal Buddha just with ribs. You know, there's just absolutely no flesh on him at all in Skinny Buddha Cave. But the place that really gripped me was Raj Gir or Raja Gaha, because it was where the Buddha had taught, and I meditated at this site. And there's something, I think, quite special going to places where doing a sort of pilgrimage to places where people who are really important to us or have been, are important to us now, live their lives. I know Subhuti, Autumn Member called Subhuti, has done the same thing with the place where the Satipatthana Sutta was given. He's been to Delhi, and there's a very near Delhi. He's found the place where the Satipatthana Sutta was taught. I haven't been there myself. But at the time of the Buddha made a specific journey to this place. It was the place of a people known as the Kurus, Kuru country. And he travelled there, he walked there, as he used to walk everywhere, which is, I think I've said here before, the symbol of the Buddha walking is quite an important one, personally, for me. So you have the Buddha just walking very steadily, long distances across India, gets to Delhi, gets to the place of the Kurus. And he decides he wants to teach, them a particular, give a particular teaching, which he's not given before, we're led to believe. Nothing is written down, so you know you never know with history. You never know quite what it is. But this is what we've got, the story that we've got. It's very unusual for the Buddha to just take the initiative and decide he's going to speak about something. Usually, he responds to a request. Responds to somebody comes to him with a problem, or somebody asks him about particular aspect of their practice, and he'll speak to that. But this time he decides he wants to speak to the Kurus. What it says in the commentaries to the suttas is that the Kuru people were they were healthy, happy, economically stable, and quite intelligent people. They had quite a lot going for them. So I guess there's a question in my mind, you know, did the Buddha sort of pick in a way what he saw as fertile ground to seed this teaching, this central teaching of the Satipatthana Sutta? He taught the teaching, he didn't give it just to the monks and the nuns, the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis. He taught the monks, nuns, lay women and lay men. So all four sort of wings of the Sangha. And it sounds like he chose well, because also in the commentaries it talks of how the Satipatthana practice really did catch there. People carried on. It says the right down to the servants of the households. The women used to sort of meet over the wells or at the rivers doing the washing and talk about practice, talk about how their practice was going. The nuns used to train their pet parrots to say ati, which means bones. So basically they were reminding themselves of the teaching of impermanence, which runs this thread through the Satipatthana Sutta. So yeah, good conditions, and the Satipatthana Sutta in one form or another has spread through all the major traditions in Buddhism. It's a very strong practice within Theravada Buddhist countries. But it's also gone into the more Mahayana tradition and the Vajrayana traditions through Mahamudra and Dzogchen. So it's a very long sutta compared to some of them, and it's very repetitive. Sometimes on retreats that I lead, we'll read it out loud. We'll sort of just pass it around, and there's a certain rhythm to it. And when you're practicing it, it's actually very nice to hear it out loud. The meditation teacher, Larry Rosenberg, described it as a dry, extended spiritual telegram on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, as the most significant teaching that he'd come into contact with in this lifetime. And it contains, the sutta contains a lot of different teachings, a lot of different ways of meditating. For example, there's, you meditate using the breath, using or working with the hindrances to meditation, with the elements, air, earth, fire, water. With there's a whole meditation based around the body and its anatomical parts. So loads and loads more. Also ways of meditating to work with pain, physical and mental pain, to work with desire and craving. But what it all comes down to is awareness. And that's the main tool, that is the main way of working with all of these things, is through mindfulness, through working with them. And all this variety points to that, it points to something really important, that we can be aware of anything. There's nothing that needs to be excluded from awareness. From very complex, complex, subtle, or gross, or really sort of simple experiences, they can all just be known in this quite ordinary, quite direct way. Essentially, mindfulness says, can I be with this? Can I be with this moment? And the next, and the next. So I see the sutta as having this huge sort of arc, if you like. It starts with quite simple objects of experience. It starts with the breath, the body. And it goes from quite simple objects to what Sangharakshita talks about, a deep discriminative understanding. So from very simple knowing to deep wisdom of how things are. It covers what we call samatha meditation, so it covers meditation that involves us in calming and stilling the mind, helping the mind be a bit more steady and stable so that we can notice what's happening. And from that place of steadiness and stability, clear seeing, insight practice is able to start to fruit. So there's a little bit at the beginning, I'm going to read you a little bit from the beginning of the sutta. Actually, it's at the end as well. Yeah, I'll read it from here. So this is how the sutta starts, and it's the penultimate thing that's said. And I'm going to use the term bhikkhus, which is what it said. Bhikkhus in this instance is referring to, as I said before, all the Sangha as a whole. Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nirvana, awakening, namely the four satipatthanas. So this is the direct path. And Analia uses it here, the direct path to realization. There's different ways that that is translated, this direct path, but really it can mean sort of the one going way or something. There's different or the actually I can't quite remember the other versions, to be honest now, but it's always looking to our direct experience. The direct path is looking to direct experience, to what's actually happening in our experience. It's the way of mindfulness. And I think we need a lot of kindness with this sort of approach. Let me know if you can't hear me because of the rain. Up a bit. So we need a quality of awareness that I was saying has a lot of kindness in it, that has quite a strong degree of acceptance and allowance to enable that awareness of whatever's happening to be to not be excluded from our experience. So the direct path is can be a challenging one. We can see things about ourselves that perhaps we'd rather not. You know, we'd rather not see quite so directly our moments, and we all have them, of pettiness or resentment or greed. But the sutta is encouraging us to have a really good look at what's really happening, rather than perhaps what we'd like to be happening in our experience, what suits the sort of self-image that we have. So I want to read you now the what's right at the end of the sutta, the final... it's just before the end. So this is this called the prediction. So if you like, it gives you a sense of potential of this way of practice. It asks a lot. Mindfulness practice, I think, asks a lot. But the rewards are great. See what you think. Bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected. Either final knowledge, here they're talking about awakening or enlightenment, here and now, or if there is a trace of craving left, non-returning, which is very far up the scale, but not quite at enlightenment. Let alone 7 years, 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 7 months, 6 months. You see what I mean about the repetition. 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month. If anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging, non-returning. So it was with reference to this, it was said. And it says the direct path again. So often when I read that quote, I'm on a 7-day retreat, so it's very encouraging for people. So they've just been meditating for 7 days. We've got a slightly more extended period. We've got about 3 months to just find more and more ways into the practice of awareness. So I want to say a little bit about, just a bit more about mindfulness itself. So I tend to think of it in terms of how we're aware and what we're aware of. So there's two aspects. So taking the what we're aware of first. In the sutta, it comes under four different satipatthanas. One related to body, one relating to a sort of feeling or sort of hedonic tone, a feeling tone to experience. And then the third one is related to mind states. And the fourth one is related to a mysterious thing that we call dhammas, which is really the perspective on which we hold our experience of a totality of body and mind. So that's we'll be going into those throughout the coming weeks in a number of different ways. The how we're aware is really partly what Vajrapriya covered last week, and I'm going to say a little bit more this week. So it's the attitude with which we are aware. It's not as if we can be aware in any old way and it will have this will have all these wonderful benefits of practicing mindfulness. Sangharakshita has talked in the past about you can't have, well, he will say a bank robber can be very aware, you know, can be very sort of alert and focused and concentrated on what they're doing, but it's not mindfulness in this sense. Or a cat sitting at a mouse hole can be similarly alert. The attention is not going anywhere, ready and waiting. But similarly, not mindfulness, not awareness. Mindfulness is something that is holds our values, our sense of meaning. It's not separate from those things. It's in line with our aims and with our values. Sangharakshita talks about it as an intelligent and responsive awareness, responsive to a situation, to a person, to our own experience. So last week, Vajrapriya talked about the warp and the weft. Had to make sure I got that right. I wasn't sure if it was warp and west, weft. They said no warp factor, so I've got it now. Warp factor and weft. So you've got the fabric of mindfulness. These different dimensions of mindfulness, of the dimension of remembering, of intentionality, and then threading through that present moment dimension. So I'm not sure if I'm bringing. I think maybe it's another dimension, but or maybe it's just illuminating another aspect of what we call right mindfulness into the same image. So I was thinking about I was thinking about colour. I have a really beautiful skirt that I got made for me. I got the fabric in Burma, and the colours are really beautiful blues. But it's got these sort of threads of tiny sort of gold and silver threads going through it. And you see that in a lot of, I think in South America, in the Mayan culture, you see that a lot as well, these very bright colours. And then these just beautiful sort of, almost like shiny sort of fabrics or threads going through. And also Tibet, colours in Tibet. So the thread of colour, I think, for me points to two things. It's, one is the quality of energy, quality of effort, with mindfulness, with awareness. You know, what's helpful? What sort of quality is helpful? And what we need is something that's quite light, sort of a receptive, open quality of energy. Sensitive to what's needed. If we put a lot of power into awareness, sometimes we sort of we it's too much for if what we're noticing is quite subtle, the energy can sort of, the power that we're with which we're looking can sort of blow it out of the water, blow it out of the mind stream. So we need to be quite sort of subtle. Perhaps like you have to be prepared really for nothing much to happen. Right, I think a bit like bird watching. If you're sitting in a hide and you sort of got to be there, not necessarily thinking that anything, you're going to see anything really special. You're prepared to sort of wait and just sort of hang out there. So the energy is quite settled back. You're still present. You still have the intention to be aware, but you're not pushing. On the day retreat on Sunday, I was talking about having an agenda. So you're not, you haven't got an agenda about what you want to happen or what you're trying to observe. Just settling back. There's an order member in Cambridge who talks about reducing unnecessary effort. He's written a book about, it's Tai Chi and meditation, and that his big thing is reducing unnecessary effort. And I think so often we put a lot more effort into our meditation practice than we need to. So you can have this idea of settling into an armchair, settling back in your mind's eye into this relaxed, open position. It doesn't actually take a lot of energy to be aware of anything, actually. So we'll do something just for a couple of minutes to touch, make your fingers touch, your fingers and possibly your the edges of your palms. And you might want to remake that contact, hold it for a little while, and then separate and remake that contact. And just see how much energy it takes to notice those sensations. You don't have to be with them all the time. The mind will sometimes go off. The intention is to just be aware and notice the sensations. Does anyone think it takes a lot of energy? I'll take that as a no. So it's minimal energy, really, or effort required. So the second thing to do, this colour dimension of awareness, is more an emotional quality. It's how we approach our experience. What's the helpful emotional attitude? And here I want to bring on, as I quite often do, bring on David Attenborough from Stage Left. So in the Mindfulness in Schools program, which is, as it sounds, it's a program for teenagers. They teach teenagers mindfulness to help with exam stress and other sorts of stress. And they have a little slot. They have what they call David Attenborough Mind. And David Attenborough, I mean, he, for one thing, he has this really sort of quirky body language. More so if you watch programs of his when he was younger. He squirms, he wriggles, he contorts his face. He's so into what he's saying. It shows in his whole body. But the other thing about him is that he is so enthusiastic about whatever he observes, whatever it is in nature. And it can be really the most ugly or sort of minuscule or nondescript bug. But to him, it's like a wild, big wild cat or something. He has the same sort of feeling of wonder about whatever it is that he's observing. So there's a lack of sort of you know, obviously he's seeing the difference, but he's not prioritizing or giving one more importance than the other. There's a sense of very sort of open interest. In some ways, it's a bit like the fifth stage of the metta bhavana, where we're not looking to discriminate between different people, but it's that open dimension of mindfulness, of awareness. So there's a sense of awareness being quite vivid and alive, and increases the sense of our alive engagement with life, with our experience. So a final image I want to leave you with. My printer was on strike this afternoon, so I couldn't print out a sutta called the Sona Sutta. And this sutta is basically a conversation the Buddha is having with a bhikkhu, a monk called Sona. And Sona has gone into the woods, and he's trying really hard in his practice, and he's saying to himself, I'm trying really hard. Why isn't anything happening? Yeah, it's happening for other people. I'm sure I'm trying as at least as hard as them, if not harder. And what's going on? So he comes out of the woods eventually, and the Buddha, who has this mysterious ability to see what's going on in his monks' heads, calls him, and they have a little chat. And I think the story is that he knows that Sona was a musician in his life before he was a bhikkhu. So he says, Sona, what happened when your vina, which is a little bit, it's like a lute, when you tighten the strings too tight, what sort of sound did you get? Oh God, Sona would say, no, it wasn't a good sound. It's not the way to play the vina. And so then the Buddha said, and what happened if you made them really sort of slack and loose? And said, no, that didn't work either. He says, it's just like that with energy. We have to sort of tune it right. You know, we have to have the intentionality, the remembering. We have to have interest and engagement. And we have to be alive to what's happening in the present moment. So all of these things come together, all of these things help us balance the quality of awareness.